Welcome to Nocturnal Tales. Tonight, we step into the grand halls of Castle Court, where Lady Eversley unveils the legendary Star of Castle Court. Moments later, under the hush of polite applause and dimmed lights, the impossible happens. The diamond is gone. With every witness a suspect, Hercule Poirot must untangle an evening of perfect timing, mirrored illusions, and very human motives. Before we begin, tell us in the comments, where in the world are you watching from tonight? We love seeing our little map of mystery light up across the globe. Producing these stories, writing, narrating, illustrating, takes many hours, and your backing helps us keep the quality high. If you'd like to support the work, you can join our membership for ad-free listening and exclusive tales, or leave a small tip. And should supporting directly not be possible, your engagement, listening, commenting, sharing, is itself a form of support we treasure. Now, let the story unfold. Chapter 1. The Statement of Captain Hastings. It is best, perhaps, that I set down first my own impressions of that curious evening at Castle Court, for I was present throughout, and if I did not perceive what was under my very nose, I can at least vouch for the order of events. I have often reflected that the modern world moves too fast for clear thinking. One is whisked along by trains, motor cars, and social obligations, until, when a thing of consequence occurs, one has only a confused notion of what one has seen. In this instance, however, I took pains to note the time by the French clock in the music room, an elegant contraption with cupids and an air of frivolity ill-suited to what followed. Castle Court, the seat of Lord and Lady Eversley, is a fine house of mellow stone and excellent proportions. The reception in question was arranged to display the celebrated Castle Court diamond, the Star, as society calls it, a stone of such icy brilliance that one had a sensation of being stared at rather than the other way round. It had, I am told, a history of vanishing acts, hidden during the Commonwealth, found in a chimney in the reign of Queen Anne, and once pledged to meet a racing debt. There is, I understand, a point at which the fortunes of certain noble houses are measured in carats. Poirot and I arrived at 9:15. He was in one of his immaculate dinner jackets, an orchid in his buttonhole, and with that air of pleasure he takes in neat arrangements, of flowers, of courses at table, of facts. He regarded the butler's silver salver for our cards with as much satisfaction as if he had just placed the last piece in a jigsaw puzzle. "Order, my friend," he murmured to me as we surrendered our hats and coats. "It is the little god who keeps chaos outside. Observe. 3 footmen, each with his duty. A program card. And there, may we, the case for the jewel, placed so the light is favorable, and the mirrors behind to give the sparkle. Someone here has thought a little." The display had been arranged at the far end of the music room, on a low dais. A glass case of the newer type, metal frame, cunningly locked, stood upon a walnut table, and behind it a tall pier glass doubled the gleam so that, to the eye, there seemed 2 diamonds where in fact there was only one. I account this important, because more than once I saw a guest glance to the right-hand diamond in the mirror when the true stone lay a foot to the left in the case. Such tricks of reflection are the devil in a crowd. The company was of the usual sort, neighbours of rank, a sprinkling of town people who had motored down, and 1 or 2 of those modern experts upon anything and everything. Among them, I recall Lady Eversley's secretary, Miss Harbury, a neat, pale woman with sharp eyes, a young gentleman of charm and rather too facile laughter, Mr. Basil Carew, and a French lady's maid attending a dowager who favoured a peacock blue wrap and had strong views on the inferiority of English champagne. I also noticed the family physician, Dr. Halberd, whose manner suggested a man for whom late hours were a professional necessity and a personal trial. There is always at such gatherings a moment when the tide of the evening turns, when the first effervescence has done its best and the machinery of the program must assert itself. At precisely 9:30, the clock in the music room chimed and the orchestra hired from Harbury and Pike's stopped upon the instant. Lady Eversleigh stepped up to the dais. She was a handsome woman of the kind who look better under candlelight than in the cruel honesty of mourning. She spoke briefly, a family jewel, a charitable cause to benefit from the ticket proceeds and so on. Then she produced from her chatelaine a small key, and there was the delicate business of opening the case. I was near enough to see the diamond itself when the lid lifted. It was mounted simply, as great stones are, in a claw setting. A rope of pearls lay beside it, presumably for contrast. I am no judge of such things, but even I felt the peculiar quality of the star, not warmth, but a cold fire, as though one had caught the edge of snow at noon. Lady Eversleigh closed the case again with the same key, turned to the company, and announced that guests might approach in order, two or three at a time, to view the jewel. This, I now think, was the first misstep. Nothing so tempts a crowd to jostling as the notion of orderly procession. There was a movement forward, the sort of civilized crush one gets in the foyer of a theatre, and, for the next 10 minutes, a steady passage of persons passed the case, with the orchestra playing a waltz to amuse those who waited and to quiet the nerves of those who feared somebody would sneeze upon the glass. I stood somewhat to the right, near a tall palm by the open doors that gave on the terrace. The night air came in at intervals, stirring the curtains and bringing a scent of damp box hedge from the Italian garden below. From this vantage I saw successively Mr. Carew bend very low over the case. He made a quip to the effect that its sparkle outshone even the eyes across the room. He had a deplorable habit of turning compliments into public remarks. Miss Harbury consult a list in a small notebook, and then direct the butler to admit the next group, and the French maid, Mademoiselle Leduc, I later learnt, pass lightly behind the velvet rope to retrieve her mistress's dropped handkerchief. On each of these, Poirot's green eyes fell, not long, but with that peculiar bright attentiveness, like a cat's when a leaf moves. "Mon ami," he said, "do you observe that the little switch for the wall sconces is behind the Corinthian pilaster there?" "Upon my word, I did not," said I. "The arrangement is convenient," he returned thoughtfully. "When one wishes to give emphasis to a sparkle, one darkens and, eh bien, the eyes dilate. The contrast is more dramatic. See, already it is done. They lower the lights a trifle to flatter the jewel." So they had. The room never dim seemed to breathe. Shadows grew in the corners, and the star burned like frost under a moon. The effect upon the guests was agreeable. It was at this precise juncture that a small interruption occurred. A footman, passing with a tray, jostled the tasseled cord. A lady cried out softly, only from surprise, and a glass somewhere rang upon marble as though making a tiny complaint. It was nothing. Yet I remember a swirl, a tightening in the crowd, and, if I'm not mistaken, the faintest check in the orchestra's rhythm. Then it all went forward again with that self-conscious ease which follows a trifle of awkwardness. What follows must be stated with all exactness. At 9:50 by the same French clock, Lady Eversleigh again mounted the dais with her husband. She thanked the guests, mentioned that the diamond would be replaced in the strong room for the night, and held out her hand for the key. The butler, Lennox, presented it on a salver. The glass lid lifted, neatly, smoothly. The case was empty. There was no scream. That would have been too theatrical. Instead, there came a kind of collective intake of breath, like the sea drawing back before a wave breaks. Lady Eversleigh's hand remained poised. Her face did not change. I have seldom admired a woman more. Then, in a voice slightly lower than before, she said, "Lennox, call Inspector Graves." Poirot was not at my elbow. He had left me, no doubt, for some vantage nearer the dais. I saw him now, standing quite still, his head a little on one side. His eyes travelled not to the empty case, but along the polished floor between the dais and the terrace doors. Then he glanced up to the pier-glass. One might have thought he was admiring himself, but I know better. "What in the world?" I began, and then checked, because an instinct older than reason told me to keep my mouth shut and my eyes open. The first movement after that silence was curious. No one surged forward. Lady Eversley's manner forbade it. But people looked at one another in that direct, unbecoming way even well-bred people will when fear touches the pocket. The orchestra leader, with an admirable sense of propriety, brought the waltz to a quiet conclusion, and then held up his bow as if a conductor's baton were concealed within. Miss Harbury had that crisp air of a woman about to write a memorandum to fate. The French maid's face, I noticed, wore a rather too intent innocence, which is the guilty look of the innocent. Mr. Basil Carew tried to laugh and could not. Inspector Graves, when he appeared, he had been asked to remain within call, was a square-built man with a mild expression that could be mistaken for stupidity by those who like to deceive themselves. He spoke briefly to Lady Eversley, then to Lennox the butler, and then asked that no one leave the room. The doors to the terrace were closed. A footman was posted. Windows were looked to. It is astonishing, the number of exits a single civilized room contrives to possess. I, being neither host nor guest of such consequence as to be consulted, remained where I was, but not idle. One picks up the atmosphere of a regiment. Habits of observation are not lost in civilian life. I can say, therefore, that the period between the first dimming of the lights and the discovery of the loss cannot have exceeded 20 minutes, that during this time a steady but not disorderly stream of people approached and withdrew from the dais, that the terrace doors stood ajar for most of that interval, and that a draught from the garden stirred the curtains so that the fringe of the velvet rope moved, slightly like a whisker. It will be said, and I expect it will be said repeatedly, that I saw nothing that a policeman could not have seen. That may be true, but I did observe one or two particulars which, if not vital, are at least pertinent. The first is a scent, verbena, I think, very distinct when the lights were lowered, and seeming to come not from a woman's dress, but from a man's handkerchief or gloves. The second is a shadow at the library window, no more than a darker shape behind a curtain. At the moment when the orchestra faltered after the footman's mishap, I cannot swear to it, but I had the odd sensation of being watched from without, as one sometimes feels in a gallery when a portrait's eyes appear to follow one about. When at last Poirot came to me, he did not waste words. "You have noted the times, Hastings?" "Yes," I said. "The case was first opened at 9:30, closed again, and then when it was opened at 10:50, the diamond was gone." He nodded. "Bonne. And you stand here near the doors to the terrace. You smell the verbena. You see, perhaps, a shadow. You observe also the mirror, the reflection. How easily the eye is deceived." He lifted a finger. "It is always the eye, mon ami. The poor brain receives what the eye, that artist without scruple, presents to it, and we say, voila, the truth. But the eye paints, it does not photograph." "What do you make of it?" I demanded. He smiled, the tiniest curl at the corner of that precise moustache. "That is not for my testimony, but for that of others. We will let them tell us where they were, what they saw, whom they touched. From the little lies, the big truth, it will come." Inspector Graves approached us at this point, and with a politeness that did him credit, asked Poirot if he would assist in taking statements. Lady Eversley added her entreaty with a look that would have melted a less gallant heart than mine. Poirot bowed, but his eyes remained bright and measuring. "I will listen only," he said. "It is the witnesses who will speak." He touched my sleeve. "You, mon ami, give first the account, plainly, exactly. Do not embroider with the little opinions that love to attach themselves. Say only what was for you." "This I have now done to the best of my ability. If I have omitted the trifles which are dear to Poirot, crumbs, threads, a scuff upon a polished floor, it is because they do not imprint themselves upon a mind such as mine, formed for larger outlines. He will, I trust, supply the rest. As for the diamond itself, it had vanished as cleanly as if one of the cupids on the French clock had pinched it between two chubby fingers and flown off. Of what happened next? The secretary's account, Mr. Carew's airy explanation, and the remarkable detail provided by the French maid, I shall set it down in the chapters that follow, each in its turn, as we heard them that night at Castle Court. Chapter 2. The Statement of Lady Eversleigh. Lady Eversleigh received us in her boudoir, a delicate apartment adjoining her dressing room, where the scent of Parma violets seemed to linger in the pale upholstery. She had changed from her evening gown into a robe of silver tissue, the sort of garment which implies both wealth and the ability to wear it without being outshone. Even so, I detected the fine tension about her eyes, the faint tightness of the lips that spoke of a woman holding herself under the severest discipline. Poirot, who can be as gallant as any knight-errant when the occasion calls for it, bowed over her hand in that foreign manner which English women pretend to find excessive, but which in reality they secretly enjoy. "I will be as brief as possible, madame," he said, settling himself in a low chair with an air of respectful attention. "It is your account only that we desire, what you yourself saw and did, and what you heard from your own lips, the facts, arranged with order." Lady Eversleigh inclined her head slightly, as though she were accustomed to such requests, and had no objection to fulfilling them. "Very well, Monsieur Poirot. This evening was intended, as you know, to be in aid of the soldiers' convalescent fund. My husband and I thought that the star might serve to attract interest, perhaps even encourage certain subscriptions that have been, shall we say, long promised. I took the diamond from our bank in London yesterday morning, accompanied by Lennox, our butler. It remained in its Morocco case until this evening, when I myself placed it in the display case in the music room just before the guests arrived." "You alone had the key to this case?" asked Poirot. "Yes. The case is of a special construction, with a spring lock that cannot be opened by accident. The key hangs upon my chatelaine. You may see..." She held it up, a tiny golden implement, more delicate than most pencil leads, which glittered against the silver folds of her gown. "And until you opened the case before the guests, it was not touched?" "No, I am certain of it." Poirot inclined his head. "Proceed, if you please." She went on, her voice composed and level. "After I displayed the diamond, I closed the lid and turned the key in full view of the assembly. The guests began to approach in small groups. I remained near the dais for a few minutes, then moved among the company. My husband took my place beside the display, and Lennox stood to the other side of it to ensure that the glass was not smudged or interfered with."
"You left the display without your husband or the butler?"
"For perhaps 3 or 4 minutes. I was speaking to Lady Montford and Mrs. Jerome about the arrangements for the charity raffle. At one point I heard a faint commotion. A tray dropped, I believe. But it was nothing to alarm one." I returned to the dais in time to see Mr. Carew bending over the glass case in conversation with the orchestra leader. Shortly afterwards, the lights were lowered a fraction. I assumed this was deliberate to improve the appearance of the jewel. I did not inquire who ordered it. At this, Poirot made a soft sound in his throat, but did not interrupt. I resumed my circuit of the room, speaking to several people, Miss Harbury, my secretary, Dr. Halberd, and Mrs. Jerome. I was standing near the far windows when my husband came to me and said, "Shall we put the star away?" We walked together to the dais. Lennox brought the salver. I opened the case. It was empty. She paused, folding her hands in her lap. "That is all I saw." Poirot's eyes, which had been steadily upon her face, shifted briefly to a small table near the window where a fan lay half opened, its sticks of carved ivory catching the light. He asked, almost idly, "And you remarked nothing? No one whose movements seemed out of place?
Lady Eversley hesitated, deliberately, I thought, before replying. "I overheard something," she said at last. "Two voices, near the terrace doors during the viewing. A man said, 'It's too risky tonight. Wait until—'" The rest was lost in the music. I cannot say who spoke. I did not wish to turn and stare. But the voice was low, cultivated, and had, what is the word, an amused quality. I believe the other was a woman, but she did not speak beyond a soft laugh. That, I suppose, is why I did not take it seriously. Do you recall where you were standing at that moment?
Yes, near the tall palm by the terrace doors.
I could not help starting, for that had been precisely my own position during much of the evening. I racked my brains, but no memory of such an exchange came to me. Poirot, however, only inclined his head gravely.
"One last thing, madame. The key, you are quite certain it was never out of your possession until you took it from your chatelaine to open the case?"
"Quite certain. Lennox brought me the salver, and I detached it myself." Poirot rose, bowing once more. "I thank you, Lady Eversley. You have been most clear." She smiled faintly. "Clear, but perhaps not useful."
"Au contraire," said Poirot softly. "It is the clearness which is useful. It allows one to see the one little point that is, how do you say, skew. As we left the boudoir, I whispered to him, 'What point is that?' He patted my arm. 'Patience, Hastings. First, we hear the account of Monsieur Basil Carew. Then perhaps we shall see the first thread in the tapestry loosen itself.'"
Chapter 3. The Statement of Mr. Basil Carew. Mr. Basil Carew was discovered in the billiard room, leaning with studied negligence against the side of the table, one hand in his pocket, the other idly rolling a cue ball back and forth. He was a tall young fellow, good-looking in a somewhat over-polished way, with the air of a man who spends more time arranging his tie than his affairs. He greeted Poirot with a kind of languid cheerfulness, as though this midnight inquisition were merely another form of amusement. "My dear fellow," he said, "I've been waiting to be called in like an understudy. Do I get to speak my lines now?" "You will be so good as to give us the plain facts," Poirot replied. "What you saw, what you did, and at what times." Basil grinned, took a moment to chalk the tip of a cue in exaggerated deliberation, and then perched himself on the edge of the table. "Well then, let's see. I arrived a little after 9. The place was already humming. Champagne, string music, the lot. Very smart show. I spotted you, Captain Hastings, across the room at one point. Then Lady Eversley opened the glass case and... well, it's the prettiest lump of ice I've ever seen. Positively hypnotic. I got my turn at the viewing after a few minutes. The cue was moving at a good pace. When I reached the case, I bent over for a proper look. Worth doing if you've come all that way. I may have said something foolish about it outshining the eyes of a lady across the room. Can't resist a bit of nonsense, you know. At that moment, the conductor of the orchestra, Chapman, is that his name, came over to ask about the next piece. We've met before at the Montfords. I was telling him to play that Hungarian thing I like. Gypsyish, lots of fire. When there was a bit of a kerfuffle behind us. A footman tangled with the rope, I think. Nothing serious, but it caused a ripple." He paused, spinning the cue ball between his palms. "The lights dimmed about then. Quite right, too. Makes the stone flash like anything. I stayed by the case for perhaps a minute more, chatting with Chapman. Then I drifted off towards the refreshment table. I distinctly recall having a glass of champagne in my hand when Dr. Halbert joined me. We talked about nothing in particular until the music stopped and Lady Eversley came back to the dais. That's when the fun began."
Poirot's gaze sharpened. "Monsieur, you did not approach the case again after leaving it?"
"Good Lord, no. Once is enough for me." "You remarked nothing unusual. No hand, perhaps, passing something to another?" Basil frowned slightly. "Now you mention it,
I did see something odd out of the corner of my eye. A woman's hand, slim, gloved, slipped something into the pocket of a gentleman's coat over by the cloakroom doors. Thought it was a billet doux or some such nonsense, so I looked the other way. This crowd's always up to that sort of thing. Poirot leaned forward.
You could not see the faces?
Afraid not. Too much traffic between us. The lady wore some sort of pale wrap. The man was taller, dark hair. Could have been one of half a dozen fellows here tonight.
And the time of this incident?
Basil considered. Must have been not long before the diamond was missed. 5 minutes before, perhaps. I'd just put my empty glass down when Lennox called for the key. Poirot tapped his fingertips together. You are acquainted with many here tonight, monsieur?
Oh, most of them. Small world, the country house set.
Lady Eversleigh's a brick. Always has the right people about. Except, of course, for the occasional bad hat.
Bad hat? I echoed.
Basil smiled with just a shade too much self-satisfaction. One always has to watch the hangers-on, Hastings. The people who've been invited because they're useful, or because they'd make a row if they weren't. Not my business to point fingers, though.
Poirot rose smoothly.
On the contrary, monsieur, in a theft, it is always everyone's business. But we will pass to the next witness and see if the pieces arrange themselves.
As we left, Basil called after us with a grin. Do be sure to make me sound dashing when you write this up, Hastings.
Chapter 4. The Statement of Lord Eversleigh. We found Lord Eversleigh in the smoking room, a long oak-panelled retreat whose principal features were a row of hunting prints, the odour of fine tobacco, and two deep chairs that seemed designed for the express purpose of keeping their occupants from ever rising again. His lordship was in one of these, long legs stretched toward the hearthrug, a glass of whisky and soda in hand. A tall, athletic man in his mid-thirties, he had the open manner of the country gentleman, but under the circumstances there was a certain guardedness in his expression. He rose at our entrance, set his glass aside, and greeted Poirot with a nod that was polite, if not effusive.
"Lady Eversleigh tells me you're helping Graves with the matter," he said. "By all means. Let's get it over with."
Poirot, ignoring the brusqueness, smiled and seated himself neatly opposite.
"My lord, we would be obliged if you would tell us in your own words where you were and what you did from the moment your wife first opened the display case until you discovered the loss."
Lord Eversleigh drew on his cigarette, exhaled a thin stream of smoke, and spoke with the measured tone of a man determined to be accurate.
"When Helena, Lady Eversleigh, opened the case the first time, I stood beside her. She showed the diamond to the company, closed the lid, locked it, and kept the key on her chain. After that, she moved away to mingle. I remained at the dais for perhaps 5 minutes, chatting with Lennox and one or two of the guests as they came up to admire the stone. There was a bit of a stir when a footman caught the rope with his tray, but it was nothing, just a clatter of glass. I recall Basil Carew making some flippant remark to the conductor of the orchestra about playing something livelier. A minute later, the lights were lowered slightly. I assumed it was Lennox's doing, or perhaps Helena's, to show the diamond off to better effect. After that, I left Lennox at his post and went over to speak to Colonel Montfort about the charity auction. We were joined by Dr. Halberd and later by Mrs. Jerome. I must have been away from the dais for 10 or 12 minutes. I walked to Helena and suggested we put away the diamond for the night. We then walked back together.
Lennox brought the salver on which the diamond was to be carried. Helena took the key from her chain, unlocked the case, and there was nothing there.
Poirot's voice was soft.
"You did not notice anything amiss in the case before it was opened?"
"No. From where I stood on the floor, the stone looked to be in place, gleaming away under the lights. I was as surprised as anyone when the lid was lifted."
"You say from where I stood? Were you always directly before the case?"
"Not always. Guests stood between me and it from time to time. but I never left the dais without Lennox beside it."
Poirot inclined his head. "You saw nothing? No guest lingering too long, no hand passed inside the rope?"
Lord Eversley gave a short laugh without amusement.
"Poirot, in a crowd like that, you see plenty of lingering and hands, but nothing I'd have thought more than idle curiosity or some fellow trying to impress a lady by appearing knowledgeable about diamonds. Basil Carew was the only one who seemed to plant himself there for any length of time."
"And the terrace doors, were they open?"
"Yes, for air, though I did notice a footman close them just before the key was brought. I assumed it was Graves's order."
Poirot rose, satisfied.
"Merci, my lord. You have been most precise."
Lord Eversley stubbed out his cigarette. "If you can make head or tail of this business, Poirot, I'll be in your debt. But I'll say one thing. If it turns out to be some guest of mine, I'll have them horsewhipped before they reach the gates."
Poirot only smiled faintly at this, and as we made our way back toward the hall, murmured to me,
"There is a curious thing here, Hastings. Twice now we have heard the same, how shall I say, illusion. From a distance, in a certain light, the diamond seemed still to be there.
It is a trick, mon ami.
But whose trick? And why? That is the question."
"Do you think someone took it much earlier than we imagine?" I asked.
He patted my arm.
"We will ask the butler, Lennox. He is the man who watched the jewel more closely than anyone, if he watched as closely as he believes."
Chapter 5. The Statement of Lennox, the Butler. We found Lennox in the butler's pantry, a small but immaculate room with a gleaming silver safe, racks of glassware, and the faint aroma of cigars that suggested his lordship occasionally used the place for private refreshment. Lennox stood at attention, hands clasped neatly before him. He was the model of his profession, tall, grave, and possessing that air of respectful invisibility which only the best-trained butlers achieve.
Poirot inclined his head.
"Lennox, you will be so good as to tell us, in your own words, what you did from the moment the diamond was placed in the case until it was found missing."
"Yes, sir."
Lennox's tone was perfectly steady. "Her ladyship placed the jewel in the case before the guests came in, and I locked the music room doors until it was time to admit them. When the company had assembled, her ladyship opened the case, allowed the guests to view the star, and then locked it again with the key on her chain. I took my place to the left of the dais, my lord to the right. Guests came forward in twos and threes. I kept my eyes on the case at all times, save for one moment when a footman, carrying champagne, caught the cord and nearly dropped his tray. I stepped forward to steady him and set the rope to rights. That took but a second or two."
Poirot's eyebrows lifted slightly. "At that moment, was there anyone close to the case?"
Lennox considered.
"Yes, sir. Mr. Carew was nearest, speaking to the conductor. Miss Harbury was at the end of the rope, directing people forward. I believe the French maid, Mademoiselle Le Duc, passed behind the dais on her way to the cloakroom, though I could not swear to it."
"And the lights were lowered?"
"Yes, sir. Mr. Chapman, the conductor, gave the signal to a footman by the wall switch. It is something they do at times in the theater to make the sparkle greater. The effect was very fine."
Poirot leaned forward.
"During the dimming of the lights, where were your eyes?"
"On the case, sir. The star shone all the brighter for it. If anything had been taken then, I should have seen it."
"But when the case was opened later," Poirot said softly, "it was empty."
Lennox's lips compressed.
"Yes, sir, I cannot account for it."
"During the viewing," Poirot continued, "was there any moment when a guest passed directly behind the case, between it and the pier glass?"
Lennox hesitated.
"Once or twice, yes, sir, mostly the staff when they needed to adjust something behind the dais. The guests were not supposed to, but you know how it is. Someone drops a program or a glove and they slip round before you can stop them."
Poirot's eyes gleamed.
"A glove, you say?"
"Yes, sir.
Miss Harbury picked up a glove and a handkerchief from the floor behind the dais at one point. I recall it because she put them on the edge of the table for their owner to claim. I could not help interjecting.
Do you remember what kind of glove?
A white kid glove, sir. The sort a lady would wear with an evening gown. Poirot made a small, satisfied sound in his throat.
And when her ladyship wished to open the case the second time?
I brought the salver as usual. Her ladyship removed the key from her châtelaine, opened the lock, and, well, you know the rest.
Poirot tapped his fingertips together.
Merci, Lennox. You have been most exact. Tell me, did you notice a scent of any kind during the evening?
Lennox looked faintly surprised.
Now that you mention it, sir, yes. Verbena. I thought it came from one of the guests.
Poirot rose.
Ah, that is all for the moment.
When we were out in the hall, I said, So Lennox is certain he watched the diamond the whole time.
Poirot smiled faintly.
Yes.
And yet, Hastings, the diamond was taken, so either Lennox did not see what he thought he saw, or what he saw was not the truth at all. We must now hear Miss Harbury. Her mind, I think, keeps a very tidy desk, perhaps too tidy.
Chapter 6. The Statement of Miss Violet Harbury. Miss Violet Harbury received us in the small writing room off the main hall, a square little chamber with a sloping escritoire, pigeonholes filled with memoranda, and a faint odour of ink. She was seated when we entered, her back very straight, her hands folded on a blotter. She rose without haste, and greeted us with a politeness that was correct but cool. A tall woman in her late 30s, Miss Harbury possessed that kind of precision in dress and manner that makes one think of a metronome, never varying, never hurried. Her evening gown was of dark green satin, unadorned save for a modest string of pearls. I had the impression she would have been happier in a well-cut business suit. Poirot bowed and took a seat opposite her.
Miss Harbury, we desire only the plain account of what you did and saw during the time the diamond was on display.
She inclined her head slightly.
Certainly, Monsieur Poirot. My duties this evening were twofold: to assist Lady Eversleigh in welcoming the guests, and to ensure that the viewing of the star proceeded in an orderly manner. After her ladyship opened the case and locked it, I positioned myself at the rope cord to admit guests in groups.
Lennox stood by the dais. Lord Eversleigh was on the opposite side.
At approximately 5 minutes after the first viewing began, there was a small mishap with a footman and his tray. Lennox moved forward to adjust the rope. At that moment, Mr. Carew was leaning over the case in conversation with the conductor. The French maid, Mademoiselle Leduc, slipped past behind the dais, allegedly to retrieve her mistress's handkerchief. I retrieved a white kid glove and a lace-edged handkerchief from the floor, placed them on the edge of the table behind the case, and told her she could collect them there.
Poirot leaned forward slightly.
At what point were the lights lowered?
Immediately after that incident. The conductor signaled one of the footmen. It was, I presume, intended to make the jewels sparkle more dramatically.
Did you keep your eyes upon the case?
I kept my eyes upon the guests approaching it, Monsieur Poirot. It is impossible to watch every inch at once when one is regulating a queue. I did, however, note that Mr. Carew remained unusually long at the case, and that Dr. Halberd joined him for a few moments before moving away.
Poirot's moustaches twitched faintly.
You saw nothing pass from hand to hand? No object slipped into a pocket?
Miss Harbury hesitated.
Not directly,
but, since you ask, I did observe a lady in a pale wrap place her hand briefly in the pocket of a gentleman's dinner jacket near the cloakroom entrance. I could not see the object if there was one.
I might not have thought of it again, except that Basil Carew happened to be standing near enough to witness it also. I saw him glance their way and then deliberately look elsewhere.
I exclaimed, "That's exactly what Carew told us. He saw the same thing."
Her lips tightened fractionally.
Then perhaps for once Mr. Carew was telling the truth.
Poirot's eyes gleamed.
"And the time of this observation?"
"Within 5 minutes of Lady Eversleigh's reopening the case."
Poirot tapped the arm of his chair lightly. "One last point, mademoiselle. You were in charge of the order of approach to the case. Were there any persons who did not come forward to view the diamond at all?"
She nodded crisply.
"Two. Mrs. Jerome, who said she had seen it before and disliked crowds, and Mademoiselle Leduc, who claimed she had to attend to her mistress, though I cannot speak to whether she viewed it earlier while my back was turned."
Poirot rose, bowing slightly.
"You have been most exact. You place each person as one places a book in its proper shelf. But sometimes, mademoiselle, one must ask, has a book been placed so neatly because it belongs there or because it is hiding something else?" Her expression did not change, but I thought I saw the smallest flicker in her eyes. When we stepped into the hall, I murmured to Poirot, "That's three witnesses who saw the same strange incident by the cloakroom. Surely that must be important."
Poirot's lips curled faintly.
"Important, yes, but perhaps not in the way they believe. Come, Hastings, we must hear Mademoiselle Leduc herself. It is often the little people, the domestiques, who notice the great things without knowing it."
Chapter 7. The Statement of Mademoiselle Leduc. Mademoiselle Leduc was located in the housekeeper's sitting room, sipping black coffee from a small porcelain cup. She was a slight, dark-haired woman of perhaps 25, with quick, darting eyes and an air of feline self-possession. Her black dress was neat, but a little too stylish for an English domestic. There was a Parisian set to her collar and cuffs, and a discreet whiff of scent that lingered in the air. At our entrance, she rose with a small bow, regarding Poirot with open curiosity.
"You will tell us, mademoiselle," Poirot began, "exactly what you did from the time the diamond was first displayed until it was found missing. Every little thing, oui? No matter how small."
"But certainly, monsieur," she replied in a lilting accent. "When the guest came in, I followed madame, my mistress, the Comtesse de Brissac, as far as the music room. Madame wished to see the famous diamond. We approached, but there was already a queue. Madame does not like to wait. She said, 'Come, Yvette, we will look from here.' So we stood back near the cloakroom doors. I could see the diamond in its glass box from across the room. It was magnificent."
"And you did not go forward to view it more closely?" Poirot asked.
"Not then, no.
Later, when there was the little accident with the waiter, I passed behind the dais to pick up Madame's handkerchief. She had dropped it earlier, white linen with lace. It had fallen near the back of the table. I saw also a white glove on the floor, someone else's. I placed both on the corner of the table for the owner."
Poirot's eyes narrowed.
"You passed directly behind the case?"
"Yes, monsieur, only for a moment."
"Did you touch the case?"
"No, my hands were full."
Poirot steepled his fingers. "And what did you see of the diamond as you passed?"
She tilted her head.
"It was there, shining. But, how to say, it seemed flatter than before. The first time I saw it from a distance, it was like a little sun. Now, when I was behind, it was only the shine, do you understand?"
"Perfectly," said Poirot softly.
I was baffled, but he moved on.
"And later, mademoiselle?"
She spread her hands. "I went to fetch Madame's wrap from the cloakroom. While I was there, I saw a lady, pale wrap, blonde hair, place something in the pocket of a gentleman's coat. I did not see what it was, and I did not recognize the gentleman, only that he was tall, with dark hair. There was no reason to think it strange. But afterwards, when the diamond was gone..."
She gave a delicate shrug.
Poirot asked, "You did not see their faces?"
"No.
The lady's head was turned, and the gentleman was looking away. There were many people in the cloakroom just then."
"Did you notice anything else, perhaps a scent?"
She smiled faintly.
"Ah, yes. A very strong scent of vervain. Verbena, you say. It was from the gentleman's coat, I think. When the lady slipped her hand inside the pocket, the air moved, and I caught it." Poirot leaned back, satisfied.
You have a good nose, mademoiselle. That is sometimes worth more than the good eyes. When we left her, I could not help saying, that makes four people now who saw this pale, rapt lady and her mysterious pocketing business, and every one of them mentions it as if it must be part of the theft. Poirot's moustache twitched.
Perhaps it is, Hastings. Or perhaps it is only the conjurer's flourish to make the audience look in one place while the trick is done in another.
Chapter 8. The Statement of Mrs. Jerome. Mrs. Jerome was found in the morning room, a handsome apartment lined with glass-fronted bookcases and furnished in the solid Edwardian style. She was seated by the fire, a porcelain teacup in her hand, and had the look of a woman who, in any emergency, intended to remain precisely where she was. She was of middle height, with a figure inclined to embonpoint, and wore her greying hair dressed high in the fashion of 20 years ago. Her eyes, however, were alert, the sort that miss very little, even when their owner seems comfortably ensconced. Poirot bowed.
Madame, you were present this evening, but you did not, I understand, view the diamond.
That is quite correct, Mrs. Jerome replied, in a voice that was clear and deliberate. I have seen the star on two previous occasions, once at a London jeweller's, and again here at Castle Court some years ago. I have no desire to jostle in a crowd for the sake of looking at the same piece of carbon again. I saw Poirot's eyes glint, but he inclined his head courteously.
Nevertheless, madame, you were in the music room during the viewing.
Yes. I stood near the far corner by the long window where the air from the terrace kept the place bearable. Lady Montfort and Mrs. Jerome, that is, my sister-in-law, were with me for a time. Afterwards I spoke to Colonel Montfort.
You had then a view of the terrace doors?
Indeed I had. They were open most of the evening until someone closed them shortly before the commotion. People stepped in and out, mostly for a breath of air, I think. At one point I saw a figure standing just outside, half hidden by the curtain, a man, I believe, from his height. I could not see his face. He remained there several minutes, and then disappeared into the garden. That was before the lights were lowered.
Poirot asked quickly, "And no one else remarked this?"
I cannot say, but I did not see him return to the room by the terrace doors.
Did you see anyone else of note?
Mrs. Jerome's lips twitched.
I saw young Basil Carew making a very great point of leaning over the display case for the benefit of a lady in a pink gown, quite wasted on her, poor man. And I saw Miss Harbury place a glove and handkerchief on the table behind the case, just as she has no doubt told you. But I did not see anyone touch the diamond itself.
Poirot's voice was soft.
And the dimming of the lights. Did you notice any change among the guests then?
Yes. People instinctively leaned forward. It made a little crush near the dais. From my corner I noticed that the diamond's reflection in the mirror was very bright. Brighter than the stone itself appeared from a distance. I thought it merely a trick of the light.
Poirot rose.
You have been most helpful, madam.
Mrs. Jerome gave a dry smile.
That remains to be seen. But I will add one thing. If you are looking for the sort of person who would steal such a stone, I should think it must be someone who knows how to make it vanish, without running from the room with it in their pocket.
When we were in the hall again, I said, "That man on the terrace she saw, if he slipped into the garden before the lights were lowered, could he have come back in by another way?"
Poirot's moustache quivered.
"May we, Hastings, and if he came back unseen, he might have been in a place no one thought to look, where he could be quite close to the case without being counted among those before it."
Chapter 9. The Statement of Dr. Halberd. We discovered Dr. Halberd in the library, standing by a pedestal globe and consulting a small old-fashioned watch that he kept upon a chain. He had the air of a man who disliked late hours but liked exactitude. His clothes were plain, his manner unhurried, and he spoke, when invited,
with the crisp economy of one accustomed to case notes.
"Doctor," said Poirot pleasantly, "we desire only your own observations, what you did, what you saw, and, if you please, the times."
Dr. Halberd inclined his head. "Very good. I arrived shortly after 9. At 9:25, by my watch, Lady Eversley complained of a faintness. The room was warm and crowded, so I fetched my small vial of sal volatile from my bag, which I had placed in the library here. I returned at once. The remedy revived her in a moment. As her gown had no pocket, I gave her my handkerchief, already scented with verbena, a habit I have, and she asked me at 9:27 or 8 to tuck both handkerchief and vial into Lord Eversley's breast pocket until she should need them again. He looked at her steadily. "You will understand, therefore, that any gentleman carrying a strong scent of verbena near the cloakroom this evening is most likely Lord Eversley, with my belongings in his coat, and any lady placing her hand for an instant in his pocket may very well have been her ladyship returning or retrieving the same. It is a perfectly innocent explanation." Poirot's eyes gleamed. "You observed this act yourself, Monsieur le Docteur."
"I did not. I state only what must follow from the facts, but I can say that at 9:33 I was at the refreshment table speaking with Mr. Carew. At 9:38 there was the mishap with the footman's tray. At about 9:40 the lights were lowered a trifle. I looked specifically to see the effect upon the stone."
"You seem to recall the exact minute of each event," I remarked. Dr. Halberd gave me a brief smile.
"One never quite loses the medical habit, Captain Hastings. In practice, a patient's condition can alter in seconds. I was trained to glance at my watch the moment anything of note occurs. This evening, though the company was healthier than most of my cases, the habit remained."
He hesitated, and his voice, though still dry, took on interest. From across the room, the reflection in the pier glass seemed the brighter object. The stone within the case, seen at an angle, showed less fire than I expected. I put it down to the change of lighting and the crowd leaning forward. Still, it struck me as odd.
"Odd in what manner?" asked Poirot softly. "A true diamond throws spectral flashes, colours, if you will, even at a distance. From where I stood, the sparkle I saw was steady, almost flat. The mirror showed a lively brilliance. The thing under the glass seemed paler. I am no jeweller, but one notices such differences with a trained eye. I could not help exclaiming, 'Do you mean the diamond might already have been gone when the lights were lowered?'
He lifted a hand. 'I do not assert that. I say only that after 9:40 to my eye, the brilliance I registered came chiefly from the mirror. Whether that indicates anything material, I leave to you.'"
Poirot inclined his head, satisfied. "Proceed, if you please." "At 9:43 I stepped into the library to replace my vial in the bag. As I crossed the threshold, something moved beyond the window, a shadow passing along the terrace. Tall, I think. I could not see the face. The man moved off into the shadows as the music swelled. I didn't see him again. The French windows were shut but not latched. The latch is stiff, Captain Hastings, and unless pressed home, looks closed when it is not. I secured it and returned to the music room at once. At 9:49, 10 minutes to 10 by the French clock, Lennox brought the salver. Her ladyship took the key. The case opened, and the jewel was not there." Poirot's moustaches twitched infinitesimally. "One small question, Doctor. When you first attended Lady Eversley, before the viewing, did you see the diamond close at hand?"
"Yes. When her ladyship made the initial display, I was within a yard of the dais. The stone then looked as it ought, a cold fire."
"And you noticed no film upon the glass, no smear, no, how shall we say, preparation?"
Dr. Halberd considered. "Only this. When the footman brushed the rope, I fancied I saw a faint crescent upon the inner side of the lid, like a breath mark, very slight. It may have been nothing, it may have been my imagination, but the effect was gone almost at once." Poirot sat very still, fingertips together, eyes narrowed in a cat-like contentment that I have learned to mistrust.
Merci, docteur. You have given to us the thing most precious, le temps exact.
Also, you remove for us one little spectacle that all the world admired by the cloakroom, and you put it in its true place. As the nothing at all, it is good.
In that case, said Doctor, Halberd dryly, I will add one more nothing. Mr. Carew's right cuff showed a faint dusting of rosin. Violinists know it. I mention it only because I shook his hand and noted the feel. He said he had been speaking with the orchestra. Nothing odd in that.
Non, said Poirot, nothing odd.
When we had withdrawn to the corridor, I burst out, so the famous lady with the pale wrap was probably Lady Eversley handing back the doctor's vial and handkerchief to her husband. Then that incident tells us nothing.
Poirot's eyes shone. Ah, Hastings, it tells us that it tells us nothing. Remove, 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 one by one, the little distractions. What remains begins to shape itself.
We have now the mirror that shines, the case that does not, the faint crescent on the inner glass, the terrace that is open though it looks shut, the times that are exact. We advance.
Then the theft happened before, we think?
Either before, said Poirot gently, or at a moment when all eyes believed they saw and in truth did not. Come, Inspector Graves must be heard, and perhaps also Monsieur Chapman of the orchestra. Between the policeman and the musician we shall get the rhythm of the evening and where the bar line falls upon the theft.
Chapter 10. The Statement of Inspector Graves. Inspector Graves received us in the small anteroom off the great hall, where he had set up an impromptu headquarters. A stout notebook lay open on the table before him, its pages already filled with neat, blocky handwriting. A pipe rested in a saucer at his elbow, sending up a thin thread of smoke. Graves was a square-built man in his early 50s, with hair graying at the temples and the calm, watchful manner of a country policeman who has dealt with everything from poachers to petty frauds. His voice was mild, but there was an underlying firmness that suggested his courtesy would not survive being trifled with. Poirot greeted him, and Graves inclined his head.
I've already taken statements from the staff and most of the guests, but if you want my own account, here it is.
He consulted his notebook. I was asked to remain in the house tonight as a precaution. Lady Eversley mentioned the star would be displayed, and the chief constable thought it prudent. I stayed in the small parlour by the library in plain clothes from 9 o'clock onward. At 9:30 exactly, I stepped into the music room to observe the crowd. Lady Eversley had just locked the display case after showing the diamond. Lord Eversley and Lennox were flanking the dais. Miss Harbury was regulating the queue. I remained near the terrace doors for a few minutes. Good vantage point.
Poirot nodded. You saw the accident with the footman?
Yes, that was at 9:38 by my watch.
Lennox stepped forward to put the rope straight.
At that moment, Mr. Carew was bent over the case talking to the orchestra leader, and Miss Harbury picked up a glove and handkerchief from behind the dais. Lights dimmed almost immediately after.
I saw Chapman signal a footman to the switch.
Graves drew on his pipe. I kept my eyes on the crowd rather than the case. My business is people, not jewels. What I noticed was a small movement at the library window. The curtains stirred, as if someone had brushed against them from inside, but there was no one near them at the time. I moved across to check. Nothing unusual inside, and the window fastenings seemed in order. Still, I made a mental note.
Poirot's eyes gleamed.
And the terrace doors?
They were open until about 9:47 when I ordered them shut. Too many comings and goings. I had already seen one man step outside and remain in the shadow for several minutes. Tall, dark hair, formal dress. Couldn't see his face. He did not return through those doors as far as I could tell.
Graves flipped a page in his notebook. At 9:49, Lennox brought the salver with the key. Lady Eversley opened the case. Empty. I closed the doors, posted a man there,
and saw that no one left the room until we'd searched guests and staff. Result: nothing. Whoever took it either got it out of that room before 10 o'clock, or it was never there at the time we thought it was.
Poirot's head came up at this last remark.
Ah, you also think that possible?
Graves gave a small shrug. I've seen stage magicians pull off tricks like it, give the audience a good reflection, or a dummy object, while the real thing is gone. What I can't see is when the switch could have been made with so many people watching.
Poirot smiled faintly.
That is the conjurer's art, Inspector, to do it when all the world is watching. I thank you. One last point. Did you notice a scent of verbena?
Graves thought a moment.
Yes, once near the cloakroom about 9:45. Strong scent. Seemed to come from a gentleman's coat. I assumed it was cologne.
When we left the anteroom, I said to Poirot, that makes yet another sighting of the man on the terrace. And it's narrowing down the timing. The police had those doors shut before the case was opened.
Just so, Hastings, he murmured. Which means our thief, if he used the terrace, had already gone, or else was still inside, hidden in plain sight. Now let us hear Monsieur Chapman. He will give us the tempo, and perhaps the tempo rubato, of the theft.
Chapter 11. The Statement of Mr. Chapman. We found Mr. Chapman in the card room, seated at a small table with a violin case beside him and a glass of ginger beer at his elbow. He was a compact man in his 40s, with the dark, intelligent eyes of a musician, and the slight stoop of one accustomed to hours with an instrument tucked beneath his chin. He greeted us with a deferential nod, but there was also a certain alertness in his manner, as if he were aware that the conductor's role that evening had put him closer to the theft than might be comfortable. Poirot wasted no time.
Monsieur Chapman, you will give to us, if you please, the sequence of events in the music room from your own point of view, and especially the moment when the lights were lowered.
Certainly, sir, said Chapman, folding his hands on the table. The orchestra began playing at 9 sharp. At about 9:30, Lady Eversley opened the display case, showed the diamond, and locked it again. I was at my post on the small platform by the bay window, facing the dais. 5 or 6 minutes later, Mr. Basil Carew came up to me. He has a taste for Hungarian pieces, and asked if we might play the Zardas by Monti after the current waltz. I told him we could oblige in a few numbers' time. He lingered there, bending over the case while speaking to me. Then there was that little mishap with the footman's tray. I saw Lennox adjust the rope and Miss Harbury stoop for something.
Poirot leaned forward. And the dimming of the lights?
That was at Mr. Carew's suggestion, sir. He remarked that lowering them slightly would make the diamond flash like a star on velvet. I gave the signal to young Peters, one of the footmen, to press the wall switch behind the pilaster. Peters knows the cues from our theatre work and did it cleanly. The dimming took all of 2 seconds.
Poirot's eyes glittered.
And in those 2 seconds... what did you observe?
Chapman frowned in concentration.
The crowd leaned forward, a natural reflex. From my angle, I could still see the diamond in the case, or thought I could. But almost immediately, my attention was taken by a discord in the cellos, a broken string. I bent down to speak to the player. When I looked up again, perhaps 10 seconds later, the moment had passed, the lights were steady, and the music continued.
I said, so you weren't watching the case closely at the crucial instant?
He gave a regretful smile.
No, sir. My mind was on my orchestra. But I will say this. After the dimming, the diamond seemed somehow flatter, less life in it. I put it down to the change in light, but now...
He shrugged.
Poirot asked softly, and when did you begin the Zardas?
Immediately after the incident with the lights. The waltz ended, there was a polite round of applause, and we launched into it. I saw Mr. Carew drift away toward the refreshment table then, and Dr. Halberd join him.
"One more thing, monsieur," said Poirot. "You have played many venues. Have you seen, in theatre or music hall, the trick of reflecting an object so that it appears present when it is not?" Chapman gave a small laugh. "Many times. It's a staple in the conjurer's trade. A mirror can make a perfect double. But it must be angled just so, and the lighting exact. If the real object is removed, the audience's eyes will go on admiring its reflection until they move to a different vantage point." Poirot inclined his head gravely. "Merci, monsieur. You have given me a bar of the melody I needed. Now, I think we have heard from all those whose eyes were upon the case." As we left the card room, I said, "So Carew suggested the dimming of the lights, and the conductor wasn't looking when it happened. If that isn't suspicious, Poirot." "Eh bien," he interrupted, "you have the suspicion, Hastings. What you do not yet have is the proof. Let us retire, and I will lay before you the arrangement of our witnesses, like the instruments in an orchestra. When each plays their note, the theme will emerge." Chapter 12. Poirot's Reconstruction. It was close on midnight when we gathered again in the small withdrawing room that Lady Eversley had set aside for Poirot's use. A bright fire burned low in the grate, and the remnants of coffee and brandy stood on a tray. Outside in the corridor, the house was quieter, the guests either retired or being tactfully urged toward their motor cars. Poirot sat at a small table with his fingertips pressed together, a large sheet of foolscap before him. Upon it, in a hand both delicate and exact, he had written a column of times in one neat line, and beside them names and brief notes. "Regarde, Hastings," he said softly. "We shall play again, not with violins, but with les témoins. Each will speak in his turn, and we shall hear not their music, but their alibis, their impressions, their little contradictions. And at the end, we shall know." I leaned over the paper. 9:30. Lady Eversley opens case, displays diamond, locks it. 9:33. Dr. Halberd at refreshment table with Carew. 9:38. Mishap with footman's tray. Lennox adjusts rope. Miss Harbury picks up glove and handkerchief. Mademoiselle Leduc passes behind dais. 9:40. Lights dimmed at Carew's suggestion. Chapman signals Peters. Chapman distracted by broken string. 9:41 to 9:42. Crowd leans forward. Terrace doors open. Several witnesses remark the diamond looks flatter or less bright thereafter. 9:43. Dr. Halberd in library replaces vial. Sees tall figure pass on terrace. Latches window. 9:47. Inspector Graves orders terrace doors shut. 9:49. Lennox brings salver. Lady Eversley opens case. Diamond gone. Poirot tapped the column gently. The theft did not occur at the opening of the case at 9:30, for all agree the stone's fire was then genuine. Nor could it occur after 9:47. The terrace was closed, and all exits watched. The removal occurred at 9:38, during the confusion with the footman. At 9:40, the dimming of the lights ensured that all eyes admired only the reflection, giving the thief the precious minutes needed to vanish. I said, "But Lennox swears the diamond was still there when the lights went down." He gave me a pitying glance. "Lennox swears he saw the diamond. He does not realize he saw only its reflection in the mirror, which the thief had cunningly arranged to be the dominant image when the lights were lowered. The real stone was already whisked away, by a hand passing behind the dais, in the confusion of the footman's mishap, when the rope was down and attention elsewhere." I stared. "Then that's when Mademoiselle Leduc went behind the dais?" "Exactement. She had her mistress's handkerchief in her hand, yes, but also the opportunity to see, close up, that the stone looked flat. She is no thief, merely a witness to the trick without knowing it." I frowned.
then all those witnesses staring at the case were seeing the reflection.
Exactement. Even Lennox, who thought he never looked away, was admiring the image in the mirror, not the object itself.
The trick is old, mon ami, but in the right hands, he lifted a finger.
Formidable.
And the glove? I asked. A stage prop left conveniently, perhaps by the thief himself, to excuse a stoop behind the case. Miss Harbury replaced it on the table. And if you imagine it impossible to slip a diamond into a glove and then into one's pocket, you have never watched a conjurer.
I frowned.
But where did it go, then? The room was searched.
Poirot's eyes gleamed.
Ah, mais oui. It was already in plain sight. Carried about the room on the person of one who had no reason to be suspected. The lady with the pale wrap and the gentleman with the scent of verbena. A charming distraction, Hastings, and entirely innocent. But it made every eye fix on the cloakroom instead of the true exit.
You mean,
he leaned forward, that our thief used the terrace? The tall figure Mrs. Jerome and Graves saw did not go out after the theft. He came in before it. He concealed himself behind the pier glass, slipped the diamond from the case during the mishap, and at the dimming of the lights the empty case still seemed full to all eyes. Then, between 9:41 and 9:43, he stepped out onto the terrace and was gone. I was about to speak, but Poirot held up a finger. There is one more piece, mon ami. Who among our guests had both the nerve to suggest the dimming and the skill to time the trick exactly? You will think of him if you imagine a man accustomed to performance, to the management of light and misdirection, and to bowing off the stage before the applause. He smiled cat-like. Come, tomorrow I will assemble them all, and we shall see how the Castle Court diamond was made to vanish without a hand being seen.
Chapter 13. The Denouement.
By 11 the following morning, the music room at Castle Court was once again in readiness. The dais cleared, the chairs drawn into a loose semicircle, and the winter sunlight pouring through the tall windows. The air was taut with curiosity. Every guest who had remained overnight had been summoned, along with Inspector Graves. Poirot stood at the center of the room, immaculate as ever, his fingertips together, his expression benign. I took my usual place at one side, notebook ready, though I suspected I would be no swifter in following his logic than on any other occasion. "My friends," began Poirot, "last night there was enacted here a small drama, of which you were the actors and the spectators both. The star of Castle Court vanished from under many watchful eyes. The question was, how?" He paused, letting the silence stretch. "We have heard many accounts. Most agree upon certain points, that the diamond shone brilliantly at 9:30 when Lady Eversley displayed it, that there was a small accident with the footman's tray at 9:38, that the lights were lowered at 9:40, and that from then onward the stone seemed somehow flatter, less alive. At 9:49, when the case was opened, it was empty." He glanced around, his gaze pausing for a fraction on Basil Carew. "Therefore, the interval for the theft is narrow, between 9:38 and 9:43, when Inspector Graves saw a figure leave the terrace. During that time, certain things occurred that were not in the program." He raised a finger. "First, the mishap. The rope was displaced. Lennox moved forward. Miss Harbury stooped to pick up a glove. Mademoiselle Leduc passed behind the case. Second, the dimming of the lights, suggested most obligingly by Mr. Basil Carew."
Carew smiled faintly. "I only thought it would look well."
"Mais oui, monsieur, and indeed it did look well. So well that the eye was caught by the sparkle, but in the mirror, not in the case. For our thief had already removed the diamond during the confusion of the footman's accident. In its place he left nothing. The eye, deceived by the reflection, continued to admire what was no longer there. It is a trick well known to the stage magician." Poirot turned to the pier glass. "The angle was perfect. From the front of the dais, the reflection seemed the real stone. From behind, for one who knew the positioning,
It was easy to reach in, lift the jewel, and step away unseen. The crowd, leaning forward at the dimming, made the perfect screen. On the terrace, our thief had only to pass into the shadow and wait. When the music ended and the crowd shifted, he walked away along the garden path. Several saw a tall man outside. None saw him re-enter. Why? Because he did not. The diamond had left this room long before the case was opened. A ripple of surprise went round the room. Lady Eversleigh frowned.
But I locked it myself, with the key on my chain.
Indeed, madame, but the case's spring lock has a quirk. If the lid is closed without turning the key fully home, the clasp catches enough to appear locked, yet can be opened again with a thin blade slid between frame and glass. The thief had prepared such a blade in advance. A narrow sliver of polished steel, no longer than a violin mute. Graves frowned. Then all our searches were in vain, Inspector. And now, who was this thief? He must have known the mirror trick. He must have been in a position to approach the case unnoticed in the confusion. He must have had the nerve to direct the lighting and thus control the audience's gaze. There is but one who fits all. And it is you, Monsieur Chapman. The orchestra leader's head jerked up, color flooding his cheeks.
This is absurd.
Not so absurd. Your gambling debts in Monte Carlo last spring were no secret to your acquaintances, mon ami, and the dealers in Antwerp are always eager for such a stone, said Poirot gently. You were placed ideally, close to the case with a reason to speak to Mr. Carew. Your signal to dim the lights was, in truth, the cue to complete the illusion. The broken cello string. Ah, a little accident prepared in advance to take your eyes and the eyes of others away for the vital seconds. You, who have worked in theatres, know how to angle a mirror and use light. You, who could leave at the end of the evening with a bulky violin case that no one would question, carrying not only an instrument, but the star wrapped safely within. Chapman half rose, then sat again, his expression hardening. You can't prove that. Poirot's moustaches twitched upward. But I can. After the dimming, you stepped briefly onto the terrace, ostensibly to send a page boy to the kitchens, and in that moment received the jewel from his confederate, the man seen by Graves. A minute later, the violin case was closed, its false bottom hiding the star. This morning I took the liberty of examining your violin case in your room. Beneath the false bottom, very neat, by the way, was the Morocco box of the Star of Castlecourt. The clasp still bears the print of your thumb, pressed in haste last night. There was a small sharp intake of breath from the company. Inspector Graves stepped forward, his face expressionless. That's enough, Chapman. You'll come with me. The orchestra leader rose slowly, his mouth twisted in a bitter smile. It would have worked, if it weren't for that Belgian ferret. Poirot inclined his head graciously. You do me too much honor. It was not ferreting, but listening to every note of our little symphony of lies and truths. And at the end, the melody pointed only to you. As Graves led the man away, Lady Eversleigh laid a hand on Poirot's arm. Monsieur Poirot, we cannot thank you enough. He bowed. It is nothing, madam. Only, perhaps, next time you display a jewel, do not place it near a mirror. Mirrors, you see, are as vain as people. They always wish to have the last word. And so concludes the Castlecourt Diamond Affair. If you stayed to the final reveal, you're part of what keeps these mysteries alive. Your presence, your comments, and the way you share these tales carry Poirot and Hastings farther than we ever could alone. If you'd like to help us craft the next case, you can join our membership for ad-free access and exclusives, or leave a one-time tip. If not, no worries. Listening and chiming in below is real support, and we're grateful for it. Until our next mystery,
Good night.